So we're starting we're ending rather a chapter today, and this is the next to the last chapter in the time section. It starts the section we're looking at is called Conducting Nuclear Time. Before we actually go into that chapter, that section, I want to repeat or review for a moment something that we did talk about in the orientation, and I think maybe briefly last week in the phone conversation. There's this very important line at the very end of the reading for last week. The first line of the last paragraph, when the story is its telling, appearance is its appearing. I find that to be really useful. It certainly is a theme that we've dealt with in various ways, but I just think this formulation is great. It's interesting to think about the story as being its telling. You know, what that makes me think of is sitting around a campfire or maybe in medieval times, sitting in the great hall of a castle, and the bard is singing this epic song, you know, or Homer with the Greeks, something like that. And it makes you realize that there are always two times going on when there's a story being told. One time is the time in the story in which something is unfolding, and the other is the time of the telling, right? It's similar to, this is a different example, but it's similar to being in a car driving down the road in relation to space. In terms of the space of the car, there's no movement. You're located in the car, and really you're always, you know, you're sitting in your seat, and now you're sitting in your seat, and yes, you're still sitting in your seat, and nothing has changed. But at the same time, you're driving down the road, and everything is changing. Your location in relation to the land, the landscape, is changing all the time. And the same thing is true, but now on the level of time, when you talk about stories, and there's the telling of the story on the one hand, and then what the story is about on the other hand. Now we've just learned to go to the content of what is told in the story. And that content is our reality. There's a point later in the reading today where Rinpoche talks about reality, but in a very different sense. Maybe we'll get to that. We're talking right now about just our ordinary, unexamined sense, the way that everybody grows up learning to think about the way things are. And when instead you say the way things are, the way things appear, is not fixed. It's the outcome of a story. And in the story, if you accept the story, then yes, it's fixed, and that's the way things are. But it's actually useful to think about the term the way things are in a very literal sense. I find that to be a useful phrase in English, because there is a way that things are. And that way has been set up. And what has it been set up by? Well, it's been set up by the telling of the story. So when you become aware of the telling of the story, then your relationship to what appears, to the way things are, changes, because you're no longer committed to the idea that it's reality. It's just a way that things are. And that opens up the possibility that things could be another way. So then that leaves you with the other side of the statement, which is when the story is its telling, appearance is its appearing. So again, if you imagine the telling of a story around a campfire, let's say, or the singing of a saga by a bard, or let's say a performance in a theater. It's, you know, there's many occasions like that. And in fact, we live in a time where people are often performing. You know, they're often commenting on their own actions. They're not taking responsibility for their own actions. And you might say that there's something problematic about that, because if you don't commit to the way things are, then you take this detached position or this ironic position, which is the stance, the kind of modern ironic stance that we talk about sometimes. And it seems like you're not really engaged in your life. You're not involved in your life. I think if you know, it's clear from reading TSK, from working with the book and the readings and the whole vision, that we are not talking about some kind of detachment. We're talking about a full engagement. The appearing is its appearing. This relates to something we'll talk about later, this what you might have found puzzling when he talks about the not, right? We'll talk about that in a few minutes. That appearing, let's put it this way, we ourselves appear within the appearing. And a lot depends, therefore, on our relationship to our own self. And we have made a complete commitment to our own being. If, in fact, we see that commitment, or we see our own being as a part of what appears, as the appearing of our being, let's say, then that opens it up. It opens up, it frees us in a very fundamental way. But it doesn't mean that we stop caring about our reality, about the world that we engage. Nobody's raised that objection, but I'm kind of anticipating it here. So that's one thing that I wanted to point out to people. The main thing, though, is what I wanted to say about the story being its telling. It's related to the image that comes up in the reading just immediately after that, where he says, we don't need to conduct the story in the way that a conductor conducts an orchestra. Instead, we can conduct the way that a wire conducts electricity. And I think the difference there is that we're not committed. It's like the more usual image is a mirror. The mirror doesn't care what appears in the mirror. It just is completely willing, completely able to accept any appearance. And in the same way, a wire conducts electricity, and it doesn't care what the source of the electricity is or what it's going to be used for. It simply conducts it. There's no story involved. In the conducting that we do, there is a story involved, but the story is its telling. It's not as though we want to move beyond the story. It's not as though we want to enter a realm in which, you know, there are no stories. But the stories, in addition to their content, they are their telling. So I think I've pretty much talked that into the ground. I'm not going to say any more about it unless people have questions. And looking in the chat box, I don't see that anybody has any questions yet. I'm very willing to entertain them, or if anybody would like to speak up. Okay, so now I'm going to move into the reading that we actually did for this week. As I said, it's a longer excerpt. It's a longer section than we usually read. And it just partly it just turned out that we needed to do that. And partly it seems like we can move a little more quickly now as we come toward the end. What the reading talks about here really is completely connected to this earlier point that the story is its telling, because it turns out that the telling is itself a kind of conducting. And what I mean by that, or what the text means by that really, is it has its own power. So let's go into that a moment. Let's look first at what the text says. So it's at the first paragraph in the section that starts on 148. Let us tell the story of conducting once again. So he's going to tell this story, and he's going to tell it in terms of nuclear time. And we'll talk about that in a moment. But right now is just saying, let's tell the story, aware that our telling can be a conducting, and our conducting a part of the dance. So we've talked about the dance, the dynamic of time, that you can understand that as a dance. And in the next section, he's going to develop that in terms of improvisation as a quality of the dance, an aliveness, a dynamic to the dance. Here he's saying that our telling is itself a part of the dance. That is, our telling is a conducting, and the conducting is a part of the dance. And then he says something about what that means. What's the significance of taking that perspective? He says it's a potential path of power, and it's a gateway to knowledge. And what is it that's special about it? Well, it's not bound by claims of true or false. So there's a lot, as always, there's a lot packed into this paragraph. I think the first point is that we often say that when we simply rely on the interpretation we give of our experience or the labels that we apply, we've talked about this a lot, when we're committed to the reality to which we've assigned names and labels and meaning and significance, we've cut ourselves off from the dynamic of time. What's being said here is that it doesn't have to be that way. It won't be that way if we understand that each telling, not each told story, but the actual activity of telling, is itself a conducting. And if you think about it, that really has to be, you could say, because there's nothing special about the activity of conducting. It's like the activity of eating, or the activity of seeing, or the activity of sweating, maybe you could even say. It's just something we do. We are set up to tell stories. And human beings are especially good at telling stories. You might say, and this part is just my way of thinking about it, you might say that, you know, animals tell stories, but they only ever tell one story. And, you know, that's the story of their lives. But human beings at least allow for the possibility of different stories, of creating different stories. So that power is something that we really would like to be able to harness. We don't want to give up on stories, but at the same time, we don't want to accept the truth of the story. So the moment you understand that the telling is a conducting, and it's a part of the dance, it's a part of the dynamic of time along with everything else, you recognize that this particular aspect of the dance, the telling, has a special, it's a potential path of power and a gateway to knowledge, because each telling creates new possibilities, as long as you're not bound by the claims of true and false. So that's where we're going here. And he gives us a particular story here, and the story is this story of nuclear time. In a way, the story doesn't matter so much. What if you look ahead in the book at the next chapter, which we will start with next week, then you will see that the next chapter starts by telling a completely different story. It's not as though we're now being given the truth. Oh, you know, I waited until chapter whatever it is here, chapter 15, to explain to you that time is really nuclear time. That's not the way TSK works. He's saying, if we tell the story this way, new possibilities open up, new potentials, or you know, the telling becomes a gateway to new knowledge. So let's think about it this way. We're not going to commit ourselves to this particular story. And that no committing is what it means to understand that the story is a telling. And to be willing or ready or able to operate on that level, where the telling, where the story is its telling, in addition to being the content. We're not giving up on the content. Okay. Well, I hope that's clear. I have the feeling I'm kind of repeating myself today, but these are fundamental points. Let's see. I'm going to lost track of where. Yes? Hello? Yes, I can. Okay, wait. I'm going to interrupt you, Sudhi. Although I can hear you, the connection isn't very good, and it's actually hard for me to understand the words. So maybe it'd be better if you typed it out. Oh, yes, that's much better. Yeah, I think that that's a really important point. You know, one of the things that I found myself thinking about a lot this week in preparing for this class is that we've reached a point in this presentation, it seems to me, where we're trying to understand some of the practical implications of engaging the dynamic or the dance of time differently. And one of the implications is that the past remains open in a completely different way, because the past, our usual understanding of the past, which sees it in terms of a story about past and present and future and you know, the arising and the passing away and so on, that's all a story about time. It's a way that we conduct time. A linear version of time. And that's one reason you could say that Rinpoche is saying, well, what about a nuclear version of time? That's what we're looking at here. But when you understand the story of time as a telling, then the past is not, it's not gone. It's available. It doesn't mean you can just ignore it and say, oh, that was just some story I told once. It has consequences. As long as you, well, let's just leave it at that. It has consequences. But the possibility is there for engaging it. The possibility is there for transforming it. I was reading something by Rinpoche recently that is not in TSK. It's not even published. But he used a nice image. He said, even though the building is already built, we can redo the blueprint. We can restructure it. Even though we have the we live in the building that has been constructed, but it can be reconstructed. The blueprint itself, which is the telling, you might say, is always available to be redrawn or to be retold. And that can change the past. So I'm not sure I heard the very last sentence you asked, so I hope I answered your question. Is that a reasonable response? Okay. Okay. There's a question here from David in the chat box asking about clarifying the not, not, not in terms of story and nuclear time. Yeah, let me look for a moment at my my plan here, where I'm expecting us to go, and see whether I should turn to that. I can turn to that before we do some practice and comment on that. Where's the practice? Okay. Yes. So I'll get there in just a moment. And I'll make sure to try to connect it back up anyway to the story. So we're talking about the telling. We're talking about the story as a telling, and now that gives us a tremendous freedom, and especially, and this is the point we were just talking about with Sudhi, especially in terms of the past being available to us. We can kind of reconfigure it, you might say. And so one of the reasons that that's possible is that when you talk about nuclear time, and I'm not going to try to define it right here, but when you talk about it, he speaks about it as a differently dimensioned timing. Right? He says conducting involves a prior, and as you know, prior is a kind of technical term in this book, and it means not caught in the story. You know, before the story starts to operate, there's a prior, and ordinarily, because the story is completely it covers everything. It tells us everything about the way things are. The very idea of a prior doesn't make any sense. In the same way that you say, well, the universe had a beginning, there was a Big Bang, and then you say, but what was happening before the Big Bang? You say, that doesn't make any sense. That question doesn't make any sense. We can theorize a little bit, but it doesn't make any sense because it's just this universe, and there couldn't have been anything before it if, in fact, the universe came into being. Well, stories are like that. You could think of stories as being as creating a universe, although I don't want to go too far with that right now. So when you go to the prior, you enter a different dimensioning. You don't have time with its past, present, and future. You have what he calls here nuclear time, and it's differently dimensioned. And it's because it's differently dimensioned that the past is available. It's as though, maybe a good image is, let's say you're the author of a short story or a novel, and in the novel, let's say, things are happening in a certain sequence, but you're completely outside that. You know, you're in a differently dimensioned time. And so if you want to, you can go back and change the past, no problem. It has consequences. It may change the entire structure of the novel, but the possibility is there and available for you. And the same thing is true when you think in terms here of nuclear time. And that's why you can go back. That's why the past doesn't have to bind us. So it's pretty much at that point that Rinpoche introduces the idea of the not, not, not. So I guess we have to look at it here. Let's see. He says, nuclear time is not originating time or founding time, even though that may be how it looks to us from within the conducted order. This is a little like the Big Bang image I just used. Nuclear time moves, and in its movement, it includes past and present and future. So that's what we've been talking about. It includes death and life. It includes us all. Without participating in the identities of what is included or has been conducted, right? It doesn't participate because it's not the story, it's the telling. I mean, that's not exactly what nuclear time is, but the same relationship applies. So without participating in the identities of what is included or has been conducted, it does not negate, nor does it negate negating. And then it goes to the third possibility, operating before each measured out move, prior to directionality, it is the not, not, not. And I think it actually is helpful, instead of reading this with the hyphens as saying the not, 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 I think it's actually helpful to say it's the not, not, not. So let me explain why that is. So the idea is the first not, when you talk about these three nots, the first not is the negation. So you say the story tells us such and such, But that's not the case. That's not what TSK is doing. I'm sorry, I have to use the word not there. That's not what TSK is doing. It's not negating the story. So then you say, okay, well, it's not, it's a not-not. The problem with the not-not is that it seems to throw you right back into the positive. So if we use, we don't use that expression very often in language, but we might. Let me think of an example. If you say, suppose you say, you were not remembering me. Somebody complains to a friend and they say, you weren't thinking of me. You were not remembering me. And that person says, no, I was not remembering you. Basically, they're saying, I was remembering you. But that's not what what nuclear time is doing. And that's not what the telling is doing. It's not bringing you back into the content and saying, yeah, it turns out that's the case after all. It's that, it's rather that instead of negating, it's taking you out to this other level. And that's what the third not is doing. I'm not sure that is completely satisfying, but I'm going to leave it there for now. Partly because I see that Michael has another question. David, if that's not, if you'd like to hear more, let me know. I'm not saying that we should, that you should shut up. Yeah. So, since the recorder doesn't seem to capture people's comments, I'm going to summarize that. You're saying that third not seems to be something like deconstructing the story, and I think that's basically right. But it leaves it in place. It just kind of takes all the stuffing out of it. You know, it makes the appearing, as we talked about a little earlier. So the story is there, it's not negated, but it's also not affirmed. And that's what that third not makes possible. If you read Love of Knowledge, there's a point in there, and I'm not prepared to talk about it, where Rinpoche actually uses four. He says the not. And you'd have to think that through. But we don't. Fortunately, we don't have to go that far. Let's take a look at a comment here from Michael, and then maybe we can try to move into a little bit of a practice. So Michael says the movement from telling through conducting like a wire to dancing seems a movement from the intentional through an automatic mechanism back to the possibility of being spontaneously expressive. In a way that can include our own nature and the universal unique. Well, I like that. You're right that the image of conducting the way a wire conducts electricity does sound as though we are it's turned into something automatic and we're giving up something when we do that. You know, we conduct the orchestra and that's very grand. We're the hero. You know, we're the one who makes it all come together. And that's the position that the self likes to take, of course. And then you say, no, you're just a conductor like a wire. And you say, oh, you know, it's all totally out of my control. I can't help but conduct. And there's a sense in which that's true. But there's a further sense, and that's what the idea of the dance opens up, you can be spontaneously expressive. We haven't talked yet about the next section about improvisation, the one that's called improvisational projection, but I think that's where that goes. I was actually thinking of something last night that I want to tell you this story, even though it's going to take up a precious minute or two. There's a book by a fellow named, I think, Edwin Hall, and I believe it's called The Dance of Time. Hall was a sociologist, and I haven't read the book in many years, but there's one image that stays in my mind, which I'm pretty sure comes from the book. He had filmed a bunch of people on a playground, a school playground, mostly the kids playing, also teachers and so on. And he was analyzing their interactions. He was doing this very careful, you know, video analysis, moment by moment. That's the sort of thing sociologists sometimes like to do, or at least, you know, it was popular back when he was writing this book. So he's doing a very careful analysis of it. And at a certain point, and I don't remember the details of this, he began to realize that there was kind of a rhythm, even though there were clusters of people all over the place on this playground. They seemed to be responding to a rhythm, you know, a pattern. You could see the rhythm on the videotape, that people were moving in kind of in coordination with each other. It wasn't all chaotic and random. And when he looked further, he eventually found one girl in the video who was completely in sync, let's say, with the rhythm, or in terms that we're using, who was conducting the rhythm. Now, this girl, you could see, every move she made was reflected in everything else that was happening. Very interesting image. And it's exactly, it raises this point. You say, oh, well, you know, was this girl orchestrating the whole thing? Was she the conductor in that sense? And somehow she had so much power, sort of personal power, that everybody unconsciously was responding to her. You know, actually, when I first read that, I thought, well, that was the way of what he was describing. But now that I think about it, I think it's much more that she was conducting in the way that a wire conducts electricity. She was just exquisitely tuned in. So maybe she wasn't conscious of it at all. But what that image suggests is that you could be in your own actions and your own thoughts and your own speech, you could be spontaneously expressing the dynamic of time, or the universal unique, or nuclear time, all these terms we have to work with right now. So yes, I think it's a good comment, Michael. It's a good observation. And you may have noticed that last week I started saving, maybe the week before, I started saving the chat comments and posting those as well. So I'll try to make sure to do that today, because we've had some interesting things come up. Okay, let's see. We don't have, as usual, we don't have so much time. Let's see what, let me make one more point, and then we'll just do a quick practice. We're basically going to repeat the practice that we did on the phone last week. So on page 149, Rinpoche has introduced this idea of nuclear time, and he's gone through the way in which nuclear time becomes, in some sense, the universal unique. But I'm not going to try to go into that right now. What happens, though, is that universal dynamic, let's call it, it's unique in its dimensions and so on and so forth, it plays itself out into a particular reality. And so this is basically going to be the reality that we ourselves are experiencing from moment to moment. Right? And the question is, how does that happen, or what is the imperative that leads to that? And he's talking here about all kinds of dimensions. In other words, the whole range of possibilities in our world, not only physical, but mental and so on, they all emerge. So he gives examples here. And I think here he's deliberately using words that are not real English words to try to kind of jar us into appreciating what's going on. Flatness, sizeness, directionness, pointness, derivationness, from and to and middle and first and second. All of those are available and they all begin to manifest. So how do they manifest, or how do they arise? And he says at the very bottom of 149, they arise as nuclear time emerges through the universal unique into the temporal order. So that move is the fundamental move. The temporal order, and at the very end of the chapter, he talks about the logos. Maybe I'll try to say, I'll say something about that in the orientation for next week, because we're not going to have time. But that's another way, really, of talking about the temporal order. What is the temporal order? Well, here again, I think we can use the word order in a nice way. It's the way we make sense of things. It's the way things are. It's the order of reality. You know, it has a natural order to it. It's also an order in the sense of a command. We insist that things are a certain way. That's the temporal order. So we move from nuclear time in the universal unique to the temporal order. How does that happen? He says at the very top of 150, he says the temporal order is called forth by the need for explanation and the limitation of not seeing. So another way to talk about the need for explanation that we've used from time to time is a movement toward making sense out of things. We find ourselves in a certain situation. There's this fundamental story, and this gets talked about in dynamics. This fundamental story, which is the story, here I am. That's the first thing that gets set up, a sense that we are here. There's the sense of I, and there's the sense of here, and there's the sense of am. All of those things are already an emerging temporal order. And then in order to make sense out of that order, in order to explain what's going on, we set up a temporal order. There's a Buddhist sutra in which the Buddha explains, he's talking about Brahma, who's the creator in the Hindu tradition. And he says, what happens is that Brahma finds himself alone in the universe, and he looks around and he says, well, there's no one else here. I must have created it. And that's how we get the idea of Brahma as the creator. And the self is kind of like that. We look around and we say, well, I must be the one who's making sense out of everything. And then we go ahead and explain everything that we've made sense out of. And of course, on a certain level, we say, no, I wasn't always here. My parents gave birth to me and so on. But in terms of our ordinary experience, we really do think of things as though we're at the center of a temporal order that we have to make sense out of. And that gives rise then, in turn, to the usual linear structure of past, present, and future. Okay, well, that takes us to the point where we could practice for a couple of minutes, see if people have some comments. The practice I would like to do is, as I said, the same practice that we did last week. So it's on page 145, but it's a practice that comes out of just one phrase on page 145, where it says, each appearance is a dance in time that challenges firm distinctions. And so last week I suggested that you just look around the room or wherever you are and see if you can allow for the possibility that an appearance, that whatever appears before you, whatever you see, is not a fixed structure but more a dance in time, that it has this aliveness to it, so that the appearance is its appearing. And the reason that's possible is because the telling is simply a telling. The story that gets told is the telling of that story, and the appearing of what appears in the story, and that of course includes the inner as well as the outer, is simply an appearing. So here the suggestion is that each appearance is a dance in time. And the only thing I'd like you to add this time is try to also include the sense that the whole of what's appearing. So if you're looking at a painting on the wall in front of you, you can see that as an appearing in the dance of time, and there's just a sense that everything that supports that painting being on the wall, which involves walls and history and you and painters and that particular painter and all of that, that all of that is an appearing in the dance of time. And it's come to a point, you could say, in that particular object. So just adding in a kind of a broader dimension. I know I'm pushing on the time a little bit, but let's take a couple of minutes to just engage your world, engage what appears before you, the temporal order objects, and then we'll allow for a couple of minutes of comments too. So, 2 minutes. Okay, so here we are again. And somebody's nicely been providing us these interesting sound effects, which maybe help remind us of the dynamic of time. While I want to give people a chance to write something, and certainly a chance to speak up, I see that Caroline has written something. A general point that I want to make here is that when I set up the exercise, I use the words, we can allow for a possibility of something being a certain way. We can allow for appearance to be appearance rather than being the thing that appears. I really want to emphasize that when you do a practice like this, it's important not to try to force your experience in a certain way. Just allow that things could be different. And, the kind of dance of speculation and imagination, which we talked about several weeks ago, opens up those kinds of possibilities. If you force, it's going to be very difficult, because now you're trying to create something real. Or you're trying to create a new way things are. And that is not what the TSK vision is pointing towards. Okay, well, let's take a look at Caroline's comment, and maybe the rest of you will have some. She says, I have the sense of the time before things appear and the time when they are no longer in existence. that makes good sense. You know, we're talking about a differently dimensioned time. I looked up the word dimension in preparation for the class, and it actually means to measure out. So when we talk about the three dimensions of space, it's the three ways in which we measure space. So if we talk about a differently dimensioned time, we mean time that you can't measure in the ordinary way. And so in that differently dimensioned time, there can be a prior, and there can be a, I don't know, she doesn't talk so much about a post. What you will find is that there's no from and there's no to. Okay. David writes, I've focused on the candle on the shelf before, determining what the essence of it was, specific sharp angles, oblong shape, jade color, white wick. When I close my eyes, angles in mental space appear, but not the rest of the candle. Okay, so the angles in mental space appear, but not the rest of the candle. The story of its properties is what I put together and assume. Okay, so there's a lot there. The whole idea of essence, when I was reading this out loud and I came to the word essence, I thought, that's not a word that exactly fits with this idea of a nuclear time. You know, when we say nucleus, sometimes it sounds as though we're pointing toward the essence of something, I guess, like the nucleus of an atom. But here, I think if you want to go to that word nuclear, it's more like the explosive energy. At least to me, that's the part that speaks to me the most. It's both. So when you pick out an object like a candle and you look at, you know, look for the essence or even look for the particulars of its appearing, you know, there's a way in which what you're doing is you're naming this and you're naming that and you're pinning down this and pinning down that. All of that undermines the nuclear or the, let's just say, the dance of time or the improvisational reality of time. So it seems to me that what you're commenting on here, David, is the way in which we ordinarily construct things. And that's what the last sentence in your comment says. The story of its properties is what I put together and assume. So you pick out all these properties. And one thing that we do sometimes in working more in space especially is you become aware you try to assign new properties to your experience as a way of opening that up. And so there's many different possibilities. That seems to me related to what you wrote. Okay, there's a couple of comments now, and we are running a little late. So let me take a look at those and see. Okay, so Michael says, I couldn't stop myself from straightening the mess on my desk, feeling that neither the disarray nor my need to organize it was all that nuclear. okay, I'm not going to comment on that. We'll let that be. And Bruce says, I was looking at a microphone and its long cord, which loops around, rests on the corner of a book, and then drapes over the edge of a shelf. Instead of being just there as a static object in space, I sense all sorts of pressure, sensed all sorts of pressures, flows, counter gestures, which enacted the appearance. The cord itself seemed to become a black looping cascade of time. This way of seeing seemed to show me something already there with a secret becoming. Well, that's a very nice description. Thank you. I think that, you know, it's going to show up, or you may find this in different ways, but the sense that things are not quite as thingly as we imagine them to be. There is this dynamic which you describe here in terms of pressures, flows, gestures, counter gestures, loop, and I like this phrase, a looping cascade of time. So let's end on that phrase. I will have more to say about the rest of the chapter. I'll try to cover at least a couple of points in the orientation. I said at the beginning that we were all pros now and we could just move through this, move through this longer reading. But in fact, it turns out, you know, the readings are always so rich. So there's more to be said, and I may include some of that in the orientation. So thank you very much, everybody, and we'll meet next week.